This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Only Three Questions That Still Count. Investing by Knowing What Others Don't. Written by Ken Fisher. Narrated by Paul Bamer. Preface. Who am I to tell you something that counts? Who am I to tell you anything, much less anything that counts? Or that there are only three questions that count, and I know what they are. Why should you bother reading any of this? Why listen to me at all? As I update this book in 2011 for its second edition, I've been in the investment industry for nearly 40 years. I founded and am CEO of what is among the world's largest independent discretionary money management firms, serving tens of thousands of high-net-worth individuals and an impressive roster of institutions, major corporate and public pension plans, and endowments and foundations spanning the globe. I've written Forbes's Portfolio Strategy column for over 27 years, making me the fourth longest-running columnist in Forbes's long history. I write regular columns in Britain and Germany, and now I've written 8 books, 5 of which, including this one, were national bestsellers. Along the way, and without really aiming at it, I made the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans. That's a lot for one lifetime and one professional career, but I'm here to tell you the prime cumulative lesson of my long career is when it comes to investing, there are only three questions that count, and my view on that hasn't changed since I first penned this book. In reality, there really is only one question that counts, or at least only one question that really counts. But I don't know how to express that one question in a way you can easily use for everyday investing decisions. If broken down into three subparts, I know how. And what is that only question that counts? Finance theory is quite clear. The only rational basis for placing a market bet is if you believe somehow, some way, you know something others don't know. The only question that counts is, what do you know that others don't? Most people don't know anything others don't. Most folks don't think they're supposed to know something others don't. We'll see why. But saying you must know something others don't isn't at all novel. Pretty much everyone who took a basic college investment class was told this, although most people conveniently forget this truism. Without answering the question, what do you know that others don't? Investing with an aim to do as well or better than the market is futile. I'll say that another way. Markets are pretty efficient at pricing all currently known information into today's prices. There is nothing new about that statement. It's an established pillar of finance theory and has been repeatedly verified over the decades. If you make market decisions based on the same information others have, or have access to, you will overall fail relative to what the markets would have rendered you on their own without any decision-making on your part. If you try to outguess where the market will go, or what sectors will lead the lag, or what stock to buy based on what you read in newspapers or chatter about with your friends and peers, it doesn't matter how smart or well-trained you are. You will sometimes be right, or lucky, or both. But likely, more often wrong, or unlucky, or both. And overall, do worse than if you didn't make such bets at all. I bet you hate hearing that. But I already told you, I didn't know how to express that truism as a single question in a way useful to you. What I can do is show you how to know things other people don't know. Polling for perfect truth. Why is knowing something others don't so important? Financial markets are discounters of widely known information. Whatever information we commonly have access to has already been reflected in today's prices before we can articulate our knowledge of it. See it this way. Compare markets to political elections that aren't discounters of known information. You know professional pollsters can build a sample of about 1,000 people sufficiently representative of America's voters to foresee the immediate outcome of a national election within a predictable few percentage points. That technology is mature and time-tested. You're quite used to it. When a professional poll is done the night before the election, we know within maybe 3 to 5 percentage points how the election will end. It's all based on picking the participants in the poll to be representative of total votes. Envision if someone could build a similar sample of all the world's investors. It would include every imaginable type in just the right proportions: institutional and retail, growth and value fans, small and big cap, foreign and domestic, whatever imaginable. Suppose the pollsters polled the sample, and suppose the consensus view was the market would rise next month. Big time. Could it? No, because if everyone tended to agree the market would rise next month, anyone with any buying power would buy before then. The market might rise before next month, but only a fool would wait for next month to buy. Hence, next month there would be no subsequent buying power to drive the market higher. It could fall. It could stay flat. But it couldn't rise much. This is an oversimplification, but it's a useful illustration of how whatever we agree on has already been priced into the markets by the time we can articulate it, and therefore, it can't occur. Since investors tend to be avid information seekers, the information they have access to has already been priced into the bets they've made. Instead, it's surprise that moves markets. It's what happens next that few previously fathomed. Another piece of news consistent with what people previously expected can't move markets much further since investors already bet that way, to the extent they were able. Said differently, you may be smarter, wiser, or better trained than the next investor, but finance theory says that isn't enough. No matter how wise you think you are, you're a fool if you think being smarter or better trained is enough to beat others based on commonly available news and information. And the aim of this book is to show how to find those things you can know that others can't. Investing by knowing what others don't. Investing is a difficult, lifetime pursuit. Just knowing the questions isn't enough. You must know what the questions really mean and how to use them. And then, you must actually put them to use diligently, over and over again. The three questions don't constitute a craft or a simple 3 steps to riches list. It isn't some investing made easy to do list for beating the market. If there were such a thing, I wouldn't be writing this book, and you wouldn't be listening to it. Instead, I'd put it in a single Forbes column, and you would glean all you needed to know from it. From there, you would go off and promptly become unimaginably wealthy. No, it isn't investing made easy. Instead, it's investing by knowing what others don't. In fact, that's why it's my subtitle. If you can learn how to use the three questions, you can learn to start making better investing decisions, and that should give you an edge over your fellow investors. Let's think about them, your fellow investors. Investing isn't a craft. You know some folks are idiots. You don't fear competing with them. But how will you compete with serious professionals who've had serious training, are seriously smart, and have scads of experience? The good news is, in my observation, even most professionals don't have much better long-term results than your average amateur investor. How so? Because despite many of them taking that class where they learn they must know something others don't, they forget or ignore it. Inside the typical investor's mind is the false premise: investing is a craft, like carpentry or doctoring. They don't treat investing like a scientific query session, which is what I'll teach you to do. Instead, consider how they approach it. Maybe they have a few favorite information sources, cable news, a few newspapers, some blogs, and/or a newsletter from their guru du jour. Maybe they have software tracking price patterns. They may have specific rules they adhere to, momentum investing, buy the dips, buy on bad news. They look for clues or signals to buy or sell. They may wait for the S&P 500 and NASDAQ to correspondingly reach certain levels, and then they buy or sell or just generally panic. They clock 90-day moving averages and monitor the VIX, the S&P 500 Volatility Index, or some other supposed predictive market indicator. The VIX is a statistically provable worthless forecaster, by the way, but many people use it every day, applying a wasteful mythology, losing more money than it makes. They believe investing is a craft-like skill they can learn with enough diligence and effort. They believe those who acquire the best craft skills must be the better investors. Investors categorize themselves and develop craft skills accordingly. The wannabe value investor develops a slightly different toolkit than the wannabe growth investor. Ditto for small cap fans versus big cap, or foreign versus domestic. This works perfectly in carpentry. Anyone can learn basic carpentry, though some people are more naturally gifted than others. It works well for doctoring, if you're smart enough. It works for most sports, which are craft-based. Again, some folks are naturally better at some sports than others. Accounting, dentistry, lawyering, engineering, and much more, all learnable crafts, though requiring varying degrees of time commitment and physical or mental prowess. We know learning a craft is possible because there are countless people who perform craft-based functions after adequate training and apprenticeship, necessary to craft, in high quantities within acceptable and predictable bandwidths. The ability to train an accountant to do an audit in an acceptable manner is a perfect reflection of craftsmanship. But few folks beat the market, amateur or professional. Darned few. So learning a craft obviously isn't enough to do it. Craftsmanship isn't sufficient to the task of beating markets. Finance theory says it shouldn't be. Craft won't help you, because you're supposed to know something others don't. That may excuse an amateur from failing to beat the market, but what about the pros? At a minimum, there are educational licensing requirements professionals must pass to legally advise clients. University students and doctoral candidates in investment finance spend years studying markets. They learn to analyze corporate balance sheets. They learn to calculate risk and expected return, but with widely known analytical tools like Sharpe ratios and R-squared and CAPM. And with all of this, they still can't beat the market any more often than those without a PhD. Quite wisely, after years of study, some young wannabe professionals commit to apprenticeship by laboring under another established investor. At the knee of their chosen master, they generally learn a craft the same way a blacksmith apprenticed years ago. Some became generalists, and others were specialists who made only weapons like swords and spears, while others made livery gear and plowshares. And today, you name the investing style, there are adherents, apostolic in their allegiance to the modality under which they apprenticed, armed with degrees, certifications, and apprenticeships. Professional investors embark into the world, and still, they overwhelmingly lag markets. They most commonly start where entry is easiest, the way I did decades ago, rendering advice to individuals. These are your stockbrokers, financial planners, and insurance and annuity salespeople. Some provide forecasts and prescriptions of their own, but those working for the big-name firms generally must kowtow to the firm's forecasts. This makes sense for the firm since it's the only way these larger institutions can maintain a semblance of control over their huge employee bases. Big firms hire a few folks with extremely prestigious schooling and extensive professional training who look and sound good for a role like chief economist or chief market strategist, whose main responsibility is forecasting. Industry analysts then forecast in their own individual realms of experience and training. Clients of said illustrious firms, both private and institutional, get the benefit of not only their individual broker's schooling and experience, but also that of the learned, tenured bigwigs who think bigger and wig out well when needed. So why, with all the knowledge, expertise, and battle scars out there, do vastly more professional investors lag markets than beat them? These are smart people. A lot of them are very smart. Smarter than me, for sure. You're probably pretty smart too, aren't you? You might be much smarter than me too. But that won't make any difference on whether you can do better than me as an investor. Smarts and training are good. Nothing wrong with them. A PhD is good. But they aren't enough. And they aren't necessary. You must know something others don't. And then, with that extra something, you can do better than people who are smarter than you are. Because, Mr. Crafty? It's not a craft. The answer to improving your error rate isn't in perfecting a craft, but in knowing something others don't. More academic study won't do it. The most learned finance PhD knows free markets are at least pretty efficient, although they do disagree about exactly how efficient. Passing tests like the Series 6, 7, 65, or the CFA or the CIMA certification won't do it. They contain no information not known by millions of other folks and parroted in a distilled form throughout the media. More magazine subscriptions and migraines from pondering, pontificating pundits won't do it. They're talking about what is known and therefore priced. And if they knew something everyone else didn't and told you via the media, instantly, everyone else would know it, and the new information probably would be priced almost instantly. Now, hereto worthless. I'll show you how to measure an exception to this later. You can study technical investing and buy software identifying price movement patterns. Won't do it. You can study fundamental investing and vow to buy only when PEs are at a certain level and sell at yet another level. Won't do it. You can hire someone to do it for you who has the most designation letters after his or her name, but you won't beat the market over the long term if you treat investing like a craft. Well, that's not quite true. If enough people try all this stuff, some very few will get there simply by dumb luck. In the same way, if enough folks line up to flip coins, you will find someone who gets 50 heads in a row. But who that is remains a fluke. And it likely isn't you. Nor is it the basis for investing or beating markets, and you can count on that. If investing were a craft, some type of craft, or even some combination of crafts, would have demonstrated market superiority. Someone, somewhere, would have figured out the right combination to keep beating markets. The right formula, no matter how complicated. If it were a craft in the very long term, there would be a clear sense a specific craft had generated an army of disciples who did better over the very long term than conflicting approaches. But such evidence doesn't exist. If investing were a craft, the decades wouldn't have sired thousands of investment books teaching largely contradicting craft, with gurus, pundits, and seminars touting conflicting strategies. There would be a few differing strategies at most. There would be repeatability and consistency. Investing would be learnable like woodworking, masonry, or medicine. Others could teach you. You could pass the skill on with efficacy. There wouldn't be so much failure. And you wouldn't have bought this book, because anything I could say would be passé. It's all Latin to me. Starting to think like a scientist. When I was a kid, if you wanted to be a scientist, they made you take Latin or Greek. I was a good student generally and took Latin, not because I wanted to be a scientist, I didn't, but because I couldn't figure out the benefit of my other options, Spanish or French. Since no one speaks Latin, I forgot almost everything immediately thereafter, except the life lessons in which Latin abounds, like Caesar distinguishing himself by leading from the front of his troops, not the rear as most generals did and do. It's maybe the most important single lesson of leadership, one I write about more in my 2008 book, The 10 Roads to Riches. Another lesson. The word science derives from the Latin scio, to know, understand, to know how to do. Any scientist will tell you science isn't a craft. Rather, it's a never-ending query session aimed at knowing. Scientists didn't wake up one day and decide to create an equation demonstrating the force exerted on all earthly objects. Instead, Newton first asked a simple question, like, "What the heck makes this stuff fall down?" Galileo wasn't excommunicated for agreeing with Aristotle. He asked, "What if stars don't work like everyone says? Wouldn't that be nuts?" Most of us would see the best scientists of all time, if we could meet them face to face, as maybe nuts. My friend Stephen Sillett, today's leading redwood scientist, changed the way scientists think about old-growth redwoods and trees in general by shooting arrows with fishing lines tied to them over the tops of 350-foot-tall giants, tying on a firmer line and free climbing to the tops. He found life forms and structures up there no one ever knew existed. Dangling off those ropes, 350 feet from terra firma, is nuts, nuts! But he asked the questions. What if there is stuff in the very tops of standing trees that isn't there when you cut them down? And if there is, would it tell you anything about the trees? In the process, he discovered much no one had ever known existed. Why am I telling you this? Because most of what there is to know about investing doesn't exist yet and is subject to scientific inquiry and discovery. It isn't in a book, and it isn't finite. We just don't know it yet. We know more now about how capital markets work than we did 50 years ago, but little compared to what we can know in 10, 30, and 50 years. Contrary to what the pundits and professionals will have you believe, the study of capital markets is both an art and a science, one in which theories and formulas continually evolve and are added and adjusted. We are at the beginning of a process of inquiry and discovery, not the end. Its scientific aspect is very much in its infancy. Scientific inquiry offers opportunities ahead as we steadily learn more about how markets work than we ever imagined we could know previously. What's more, anyone can learn things now that no one knows, but in a few decades will be general knowledge. Building new knowledge of how capital markets work is everyone's job, whether you accept that or not. You're part of it, whether you know it or not. By knowingly embracing it, you can know things others don't, things finance professors don't know yet. You needn't be a finance professor or have any kind of background in finance to do it. To know things others don't, you just need to think like a scientist. Think freshly and be curious and open. As a scientist, you should approach investing not with a rule set, but with an open, inquisitive mind. Like any good scientist, you must learn to ask questions. Your questions will help you develop hypotheses you can test for efficacy. In the course of your scientific inquiry, if you don't get good answers to your questions, it's better to be passive than make an actionable mistake. But merely asking questions won't, by itself, help you beat the markets. The questions must be the right ones leading to an action on which a bet can be made correctly. So, what are the right questions? The only three questions that count. First, We need a question helping us where we see wrongly. Then we need one helping us where we don't see at all. Third, we need one helping us sense reality when our eyes aren't at all appropriate as tools. For our first question, we must identify those things we believe that are actually false. The question is, what do I believe that is actually false? Note what you believe is probably believed by most people. In Chapter 1, I'll cover this question in detail. But if you and I think something is true, then probably most people do. If most people do, we can predict how they will bet, and we can learn to bet against these beliefs at times because the market will discount them and their false truths. Suppose you believe factor X causes result Y. Probably most people do, and we can verify most people believe it. Then, when you see X happen, you know people will bet on Y happening next. But suppose you can prove in reality X doesn't cause Y at all. Now you know you can bet against Y happening while everyone else is betting it will happen. You can bet successfully against the crowd because you know something others don't. I'll show you how to do this. Second question. What can I fathom that others find unfathomable? Here, we need a process of inquiry allowing us to contemplate that which most people assume simply can't be contemplated at all. It's the essence of so-called out-of-the-box thinking. It's what made Edison and Einstein so successful, but weird. They could think about how to think about the unthinkable. Think how unthinkable that is. Almost heretical. It's amazingly easier to do than most people assume, and it's a trainable skill. I'll show you how to do that in Chapter 2. Intuitively, you know if no one knows what causes a particular result. Let's call it result Q, and we can prove factor Z causes Q. Then every time we see Z happen, we can bet on Q happening more often than not because we know something others don't. Finally, our third question. What the heck is my brain doing to mislead and misguide me now, to blindside me? Another way to ask this is, how can I outthink my brain, which normally doesn't let me think too well about markets? This is the realm of behavioral psychology. One thing you can come to know no one else can is how your individual brain works, what it does well in relation to markets and what it does badly, and how to reprogram yourself to not use your brain in the ways it works worst for markets. Few investors have spent any material time trying to understand how their own brains work. Most focus on craft, not internal deficiency. Note, a craftsman wouldn't think about that at all. You can learn how your brain works to hurt you, and when you do, you will know something almost unique, since your brain is partly like other people's and partly yours uniquely. Chapter 3 covers this topic in very simple you-can-do-it lessons. From there on, the rest of the book is simply about putting the three questions to work in various ways. We look at how to use the three questions to think about the overall market, different parts of the market, and even individual stocks. We'll apply them to interest rates and currencies. We look at lots of things I've figured out over the years using the three questions. We also address areas I haven't figured out because there is still a lot of potential figuring to do. And you may be the person who figures these things out in the years ahead. We won't be able to cover everything, everywhere, nor is there a need for that. I will make a lot of statements of fact you won't have heard before, or think sound simply wrong, nuts, and crazy. I've come to those conclusions using the three questions, and I'll show you how in each case. You can still disagree with me, that's okay. But if you learn how to use the three questions and you want to explore any area, including these, and have the time, you can do it on your own later. Forever. You can use the three questions to show me where I was wrong and messed up. I'd be delighted. And you should feel free to write me to show me evidence using the three questions where I'm wrong. There are endless opportunities to discover new things in terms of what we don't know. You don't need to know everything. You need to know some things others don't know. If you learn to apply the three questions yourself, you'll be empowered to know things others don't for the rest of your life. An additional note for those listening to the second edition. Where I could, I updated graphs and numbers with the most recently available data. I left a few charts alone because they were fine examples of the point I made. I also replaced a few because, in the intervening years, I found a better way to make the same point. I also added commentary and a few new graphs in a few places. Also, there's that old saying, if I had more time, I'd write you a shorter letter. In reviewing this book to update it, I discovered many places where I could make the book more readable for you, and therefore, a better tool, not sacrifice any concepts and simply make my commentary briefer. Or maybe, some examples and anecdotes seemed particularly relevant in 2006, but much less so now. What amazed me most in reading this was how much the basic framework of the three questions hasn't changed, and that's the idea. Over time, you get more knowledge, more data. Something that once worked doesn't anymore. Something that didn't work at all becomes more relevant. The world moves and changes and is dynamic, but the basic process of a disciplined scientific method shouldn't change. Which is why these are the three questions that still count. Ken Fisher, Woodside, California. Chapter 1. Question 1. What do you believe that is actually false? If you knew it was wrong, you wouldn't believe it. It's safe to assume if you knew something was wrong, you wouldn't believe it true in the first place. But in a world where so much of industry-applied craft has morphed into long-held mythologies, much of what everyone believes is false. This isn't any different from long ago when humanity believed the world was flat. You needn't beat yourself up if you fall prey to false mythologies. Pretty much everyone has, and does. Once you accept that, you can begin gaming everyone else with greater success. If sorting false mythology from fact were trivial, there wouldn't be so many false truths. While this isn't trivial, it isn't impossible either. One inherent difficulty is this approach requires being skeptical about all your prior beliefs, something most humans dislike. In fact, most humans hate self-questioning and prefer spending time convincing themselves and others their beliefs are right. Effectively, you can't trust any conclusion you thought you knew. To think through false mythologies, we must first ask, why do so many people believe things that are false? And why do false truths persist, getting passed down the decades as if they were fact? It comes back to the same point. People persist in believing things that are wrong because, individually, people rarely investigate their own beliefs, particularly when what they believe makes sense intuitively, even more so when those around them agree with them. As a society, we are often encouraged to challenge someone else's views, as in, I know those, expletive, insert Republicans or Democrats as you choose, are full of phony views. But we aren't trained to challenge ourselves or to question the basic nature of the universe the way an Einstein, Edison, or Newton would. Our instinct is to accept wisdom passed to us by former generations, or smarter people, or both. These beliefs don't require investigation because we believe certain truths are beyond our ability to challenge. Often, in life, that is right. I mean, if they can't figure it out, how could I? Medicine is a good example. We are correctly conditioned to go to the doctor, describe symptoms, hear prognosis, and accept a prescription. Generally, that is good conditioning because medicine is an example of science and craft operating largely in parallel harmony. Not perfectly, because there are certainly plenty of myths among doctors, but generally, because over time science modifies the craft and the craft improves. Because there are so many life examples where our conditioning serves us well, we are blind to the few areas, like capital markets, where it doesn't. There are myriad beliefs you're likely to share with your fellow investors. Those beliefs have been built into decades of literature and are among the first things people learn when they start investing and have been accepted by the biggest names around us. Who are you to question and challenge them? Exactly the right person. For example, investors categorically believe when the stock market has a high price-to-earnings ratio, P/E, it's riskier and has less upside than when it has a low P/E. Think about it casually, and it probably makes sense. A high P/E means a stock or even the whole market price is high, way high, compared to earnings. Get too far out on that scale, and it would seem a high P/E means a stock is vastly overpriced and likely to start falling. This belief is so widely held by so many people, seems so logical and has been a basic tenet of investing for so long, that if you start proposing to your friends it's false, you will meet with overwhelming rejection, ridicule, and perhaps suggestions you're morally deficient somehow. Yet, I proved statistically more than 15 years ago that the P/E, no matter its level, by itself tells you nothing about market risk or return. Statistics aside, if you delve heavily into theory, as we do later, you will also learn the P/E shouldn't tell you anything about risk or return anyway. But tell that to people, including the overwhelming bulk of people who have been trained and should know better, and they will think you're crazy, a real whack job. The cool part comes after we accept the truth that P/Es tell you nothing about future returns by themselves. When people are freaking out, fearfully fretting over the market P/E being too high, we can bet against the market falling. While that won't always work because something else can come along and knock the market down, we cover how to better see that later, it will work much more often than not. In the same way, if the market's P/E is low and we can sense people are optimistic because of it, we can bet against them also. The key is understanding the truth instead of the mythology. This is basic to the scientific approach. Many false mythologies, like the P/E one, are accepted widely by the best and brightest minds and passed to the investing public through all forms of media. They don't inspire questioning from you, me, or anyone. We have faith in them, like Catholics do in the Trinity and environmentalists in global warming, and they require no further proof. Holy, sacred. No one questions these beliefs. No one offers dissenting analysis, and if you do, you're a heathen. And because there is no dissenting opinion, society feels no need to see proof of these alleged investing truisms and statistically valid data. And mythology continues. How can it be so few demand hard evidence to support generally accepted investing wisdom? Why do investment decisions not get the scrutiny that car mechanics do? We should be at least as skeptical, if not more so, of the financial industry's pronouncements. To change the success, or lack thereof, you've had so far with investing, be skeptical. Be a cynic. Be the one to point out the emperor wears no clothes. Look around and assess what you and your fellow investors are accepting as truth. But the most important person to be skeptical of is yourself. Long ago, as I read or listened to media, I'd note things I believed were false or run off to do independent checking to prove I was right. People love to prove they're right. I'd gather data and do statistical analysis to prove they were wrong and I was right, and I could prove I was right to my satisfaction pretty often. It's amazing how people can prove they're right to their own satisfaction, the plaintiff, judge, jury, and executioner all in one. But later, I realized I was doing the wrong thing. What I should have been doing was looking in the media for assertions I believed were true, and then checking to see if they weren't really false. Why? If I believe the assertion is true, then probably so do many others, if not the overwhelming bulk of investors, maybe everyone. If we're all wrong, there's real power there. If I can prove I'm wrong and most everyone else is also wrong, then I've got some useful information. I can bet against everyone knowingly. I've got one provable form of knowing something others don't. Suppose I believe factor X causes result Y. If I believe it, probably most other folks do too. But if I'm wrong, most everyone else is wrong. When X happens, people will move to bet on Y happening. Suppose I can learn X doesn't cause Y. That means something else is causing Y. That means after X happens, Y happens sometimes, but it's purely random to X's existence. Now, when X happens, people will still move to bet on Y happening, but I can bet against Y happening, and I'll be right more often than I'm wrong. If I can figure out what actually causes Y, I can take a big step further, but we don't cover that step until Chapter 2 and Question 2. With our PE notion, we can see one such perfect example. Say the market's PE goes up a lot. Normal investors notice and conclude risk has risen and future return is lower and bet against the market doing well. Sometimes stocks won't do well, but more often than not, stocks will be just peachy because the PE by itself tells you nothing about market risk and direction. When I see a high PE market and fear of it, I can bet against the market falling. Sometimes, like 2000, it won't work. But more often, like 1996, 1997, 1998, 1999, 2003, and 2009, it will. I don't expect you to believe the PE thing right now. Right now, I expect you to believe the traditional mythology about PEs and not even be very interested in challenging it. We'll get to that later in detail. For now, I just want you to accept in your bones, if you can learn an accepted mythology is actually false, you can bet against it and win more often than you lose. Using Question 1. A good way to think about successful investing is it's 2/3 not making mistakes and 1/3 doing something right. Hippocrates is frequently credited with the phrase, "First, do no harm." And it's a good investment principle. To first do no harm, you must think about what you believe and ask yourself whether it's correct and factually accurate. Go crazy. Question everything you think you know. Most people hate doing this, which gives you a real advantage over them. As stated in this chapter's title, this is the first question. What do you believe that is actually false? Asking question one helps only if you can be honest with yourself. Many people, particularly in investing, are constitutionally incapable of contemplating they're ever wrong. They will tell you they do well and likely hoodwink themselves into believing it, but they don't. And they never subject themselves to reliable, independent analysis. You must accept that you and the pundits and professionals from whom you glean information can be and probably are wrong about many basic beliefs. Me too. Have you ever presented such a question to yourself about capital markets? Asking yourself if what you believe is actually wrong requires introspection. As humans, we're hardwired to be overconfident. This is hardly a new development. Behavioralists will tell you our Stone Age ancestors had to be overconfident to hunt giant beasts each day, armed merely with stone-tipped sticks. If they practiced introspection and came to the rational conclusion that tossing a flint-tipped branch at a buffalo was utter lunacy, they, their families, and their communities would have starved. In fact, overconfidence, the belief you can do something successfully when rationality would argue otherwise, is basic to human success in most fields and necessary to our successful evolution as a species. However, it hurts tremendously when it comes to capital markets. More on this in Chapter 3. Just so, investors are loath to question generally accepted knowledge. If we started doing so, we might soon realize the market exists solely to humiliate us as much as it can, for as long as it can, for as many dollars as it can. I refer to the market by its proper name, the Great Humiliator, TGH for short. I've come to accept my goal is to interact with TGH without getting humiliated too much. TGH is an equal opportunity humiliator. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor, black or white, tall or fat, male or female, amateur or an Olympian. It wants to humiliate everyone. It wants to humiliate me and you, too. To be frank, I think it wants to humiliate me more than it does you. You're fun to humiliate, but if you're fun, I'm more fun. I'm probably a more public figure than you and therefore a bigger TGH target. Think how much TGH would love to humiliate Warren Buffett. The bigger you are, the more TGH wants you. But in reality, TGH wants to get everyone, and does a pretty good job at getting them all eventually. Can't be sated. How do you, personally, give TGH the most fun? By making the most bets you can based on the same information everyone else has. How do you spoil the fun for TGH? By restricting bets you make to things you think you actually know that others don't. Practice using question one the same way I should have, by scanning the media for things asserted you believe. Make a list of them. They can be about single stocks, whole markets, currencies, or anything. Make a list of anything influencing your decisions, whether on single stocks, asset allocation, anything. Make note of decisions you've made not supported by data or any other information. Underneath there somewhere is something you believe, might be right or might be wrong. Be particularly wary of making a decision simply because of something you know others agree with. Highlight, underline, and asterisk decisions prompted or based on common investor catechism. Ask what evidence you figured out for yourself supporting these beliefs. Is there any? For most investors, there isn't much. Common myths you believe in too. For example, you may hold a stock with a high P/E ratio. You believe a high P/E signals an overvalued stock, so you decide to dump the stock and buy one with a lower P/E. It's a fairly rational decision you may have made countless times before, and one many people would agree is rational. But are high P/Es bad for single stocks or the market? Have you personally checked the data? If you have asked the question, where did you find the answer? Did you look at the numbers? Or did you rest easy because conventional wisdom or some big-name guru endorsed your belief? Take another scenario. You hold a stock that does well in rising markets but badly in falling ones, a typical, highly volatile stock. However, you know the U.S. federal government is running a growing budget deficit. Not only a deficit, but a historically high deficit, and one that can't go on forever. You know federal budget deficits left unchecked are bad for the economy, and in turn, bad for the stock market. All that debt caused by the deficit must be paid back by future generations, and the market will reflect that sooner or later. Right? The burden of the deficit has long-term rippling implications, holding down growth and earnings. The deficit has grown to such a size you know a bear market looms eventually. In that environment, your highly volatile stock would do badly, and so you sell. But how do you know budget deficit peaks are followed by poor stock performance? Is it true? Most folks won't ask the question or check history. If they did, they would be sanguine about stocks rather than fearful. Historically, big budget deficits in America and around the world have been followed by materially above-average stock market returns. Don't fear deficits. It is big budget surpluses that have been soon followed by bad markets. That doesn't make intuitive sense to you. Deficits must be bad and surpluses good, right? After all, the word deficit has the same Latin root as deficient, and that must be bad. Most people won't challenge their own beliefs on these kinds of subjects. The notion that big deficits are bad is overwhelming. Few beliefs have as much broad acceptance from professionals, non-professionals, and folks from both ends of the political spectrum alike. A good way to get the proletariat on your side at a political rally is to vow to lower budget deficits. It's a crowd pleaser. Here's a baker's dozen of some general beliefs you probably hold, or at least most people do. We've already covered two. 1. High P.E. markets are riskier than low P.E. markets. 2. Big government budget deficits are bad. Let's think about some more. 3. A weak U.S. dollar is bad for stocks. 4. Rising interest rates are bad for stocks. Falling rates are good. 5. A tax cut causes more debt, which is bad for stocks. 6. Higher oil prices are bad for stocks and the economy. 7. Stocks do well when the economy does well. 8. Stock markets do better in countries with faster-growing economies than slower ones. 9. Small stocks do better than big ones. 10. Stocks of firms that grow more do better than those that don't. 11. Cheaper stocks do better than less cheap stocks. 12. Big trade deficits are bad for stock markets. 13. America has way too much debt. They're all familiar to you. This is just a short list, a subset of a much bigger list, of views most folks believe that are partly or wholly false. For example, the notion America is way too heavily in debt is backward. As I say that, you may be shriekingly dismissive, or maybe the statement makes you mad. It challenges your belief set. If the statement makes you either dismissive or mad, you really need the rest of this book. The most standard reaction to someone stating your belief is wrong is to be dismissive and, if further confronted, to get mad. Anger is a very good warning sign because anger is always, always about fear. Angry people usually don't know they're fearful. If you're dismissive or angry, you must question yourself to see how and why you concluded your belief was right in the first place. Was it mythology? Was it basic bias? Are you right or not? Sometimes the items in this list and others beyond it are part true and part false, depending on surrounding circumstances. We look at all of these and more later on. But the most obvious question is, why would you believe any of these statements? I'd say you believe myths mostly because of two facts. One, they make common sense, and you aren't typically prone to challenge your own common sense. Two, people around you tend to agree these things are true, and you aren't prone to challenge widely held views. Let's prove you're either right or wrong, or really, really wrong. As you attempt to debunk investor mythology using question one, you will find three basic rules. Either you were right all along, which may happen less frequently than you might have hoped, or you were wrong, or you were really, really wrong. Any of these outcomes is okay because it tells you how to bet better later. Let's examine more closely the instances when you're wrong. You and most of your fellow investors, amateur and professional, often believe something is causal. X happens because of Y. But in reality, there is no correlation at all. By now, you're willing to embrace that can happen, or you would have stopped listening to this book. The example we debunk is the aforementioned commonly held belief high PE stock markets are risky with subsequent below-average returns. As previously mentioned, it turns out high PE markets aren't predictive of poor returns, not even remotely. In fact, historically, they've led to some pretty good returns. What's more, low PE markets aren't predictive of good returns either. The mythological correlation. Forgetting for now why the PE myth is so easy to buy into, we know people overwhelmingly do believe high PE markets predict below-average returns and above-average risk. But if it were true, you could show some form of high statistical correlation between the claimed cause and result. A statistician will say you can have high correlation between two things out of quirky luck with no causation. But the same statistician will tell you that you can't have causation without high correlation, unless you run into scientific non-linearity, which doesn't happen in capital markets to my knowledge, but you could check on your own with the three questions when you're finished with this book. When a myth is widely accepted, you will find low correlations coupled with a great societal effort to demonstrate, accept, and have faith in correlations that don't really exist. Investors will root out evidence supporting their favorite myths and create justifications for their belief. Factor X causes result Y, while ignoring a mountain of evidence that X doesn't cause Y at all. Now, let's suppose everyone is of good intent. Still, even with the best of intentions, it's easy for people to latch onto evidence confirming their prior biases and ignore evidence contradicting their views. Looking for evidence to support your pet theory is human. Accepting evidence to the contrary is no fun at all. This is done in varying ways. One way is to look at a particular time period verifying the false belief and ignore other periods. Another is to redefine either X or Y in a bizarre way so the statistics seemingly prove the point, and then generalize afterward about X and Y without the bizarre definitions. Discoveries of data supporting popular myths become popular discoveries. Why high PEs tell you nothing at all. A great example of redefining X or Y is the now famous study by John Y. Campbell of Harvard and Robert J. Shiller of Yale. Their paper didn't introduce a new idea because fear of high PEs had been around forever. Their study merely introduced a new delivery of data confirming the view high PE periods are followed by below-average returns, an already widely held belief. This was actually a better redo of a study they presented in 1996, but this 1998 publication got very popular, very fast, because it supported what everyone already believed with new statistical documentation. Campbell and Shiller were and are noted academics. Inspired by the prior study, in 1996, Alan Greenspan first uttered the phrase, irrational exuberance, relative to the stock market, which reverberated around the world almost overnight and entered our lexicon permanently. My friend and sometimes collaborator, Meyer Statman, and Glenn Klimek, professor of finance at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University, co-authored with me a paper not refuting their statistics, but reframing their approach more correctly with the same data, and you will see PE levels aren't predictive at all. We basically asked question one from beginning to end. Much of what follows stems from our paper, Cognitive Biases in Market Forecasts. In their study, Campbell and Shiller found high PEs acted as people always thought they did, leading to below-average returns 10 years later. First, they noted the PE at the outset of each year and subsequent annual market returns going back to 1872, which is about as far back as we have half-tolerably reliable data. Prior to the inception of the S&P 500's data in 1926, they used Cowles data, which is an imperfect but generally accepted proxy for pre-S&P 500 years. All old databases are imperfect. Whenever you're looking at old data, there is apt to be lots wrong with it. But the Cowles data is the best we have. Then they graphed the data points on a scatter plot and found a slightly negative trend line. The negatively sloping trend line shouldn't influence you. The scatter points aren't particularly well grouped around it. The scatter plot is, well, scattered. Sort of like a shotgun blast in a mild wind. The key issue I had with the study was Campbell and Schiller based their work on an odd definition of PE, not one you intuitively leap to. They created a price-smoothed earnings ratio. The newly defined PE divided the price per share by the average of real earnings over the period of 10 years. Real means adjusted for inflation. Fair enough. But that isn't what you think of when you think PE. Right? But if so, what definition of inflation would you use? I bet you would use something like the Consumer Price Index, CPI. The CPI comes up as one of your first results when you Google inflation. Ironically, they chose an esoteric wholesale price index. Again, not what you might default to. So instead of what you think of as PE, they used a 10-year rolling average based on inflation adjustments, based on an inflation index most wouldn't think of. Got it? With a normally defined PE, as you would think of it, there isn't much of a statistical fit at all. However, Campbell and Schiller's engineered PE gave a result consistent with what society always believed, that high PE means low returns, high risk, and the world seemingly loved it. In statistics, a calculation called an R-squared shows the relative relatedness of two variables, how much of one variable's movement is caused by the other. It sounds complicated, but it's not. For their study, Campbell and Schiller got an R-squared of 0.40. An R-squared of 0.40 implies 40% of subsequent stock returns are related to the factor being compared. In this case, their re-engineered PE. Statistically, not a bad finding, although not an overwhelming one. Though not a whopping endorsement of their theory, this finding still supports their hypothesis. Note, Campbell and Schiller's study, tepid support or not, became wildly popular because it supported the view society had long held. If you present data violating society's myths, those data won't be met with great popularity. That's nice, because when you discover the truth, the world won't be trying to take it away from you in a hurry. By using the same basic data and traditional notions of PEs at the start of each year, from 1872 to 2010, and actual 10-year subsequent returns, updating this study for this edition, we get an R-squared of 0.25. The PE only potentially explains 25% of 10-year returns. Statistically, pretty random. Something else entirely, or some group of other variables, explains the other 75% of price returns. I wouldn't make a bet on an R-squared of 0.25, and neither should you. Said another way, Campbell and Schiller's R-squared was 0.40 and ours was 0.25, so a big chunk of their result was based on how they defined PE differently. This myth wasn't hard to debunk. You can arrive at the same general conclusion with Google Finance and an Excel spreadsheet. When it isn't a myth and it's real, you will find you need no fancy statistical re-engineering and no fancy math in your analysis. But there's yet another issue. Even if it were valid, who cares about views of subsequent 10-year returns? Investors mainly want to know how to get positioned for this year and next, and now, and the soon, not for 10 years from now. Would you really have cared what the next 10-year return was in 1996 when the next 4 years rose massively only to be followed by a big bear market? Would you have wanted to miss the big up years in a row, and would you have been content to hold on through the big down years? When you look at simple PEs on a shorter-term basis, the high PE is risky thesis falls apart completely, as we shall see. What's more, forecasting long-term stock returns is a near impossibility because stock prices in the long term are the result primarily of shifts in far-distant levels of the supply of equities, which in today's state of knowledge, or ignorance, no one knows how to address. Some of my academic friends get angry when I bring this up, but remember, when anyone gets angry, they are afraid and just can't quite put their finger on their fear. In this case, I think it's because very little real scientific work has been done analyzing shifts in supply and demand for securities. Yet, by definition, shifts in supply and demand are what determine pricing. There are great future advances to be made here, but so far, the progress is minimal despite supply and demand being basic to economics. We get to supply and demand for securities in Chapter 7. For now, let's consider our scatter plot again, this time using normal non-engineered PEs and subsequent one-year returns from 1872 through 2010. Note, we would have a much shallower negative trend line, and the scatter points are even less cooperative. This is our same shotgun blast appearance with a few stray pellets. Does this indicate any sort of correlation at all? With an R squared of 0.01, the answer is no. If an R squared of 0.25 is pretty random, an R squared of 0.01 is randomness itself. Pure, perfect randomness. Finding a correlation where simply none exists is pretty creative, and simply, none exists here. To begin debunking myths on your own, you don't need a supercomputer and a Stephen Hawking doppelganger. That's probably illegal anyway. If you need ultra-complicated math to support the existence of a market myth, your hypothesis is probably wrong. The more jury rigging and qualification your analysis needs, the more likely you're forcing your results to support your hypothesis. Forced results are bad science. If not bad, can they be good? We have shown there's no correlation between high PEs and poor stock results, or good ones. Even in light of such damning evidence, some may be reluctant to let go of the high PE equals bad stocks doctrine. Consider this another way. It may further shock and appall you to learn years with higher PEs had some excellent returns. Moreover, the one-year returns following the 13 highest PE ratios weren't too shabby. Some negative years, but also some big positive years. This isn't statistical, but should give you pause. Need more evidence? No complicated engineering necessary here either. There is a basic bell curve depicting PEs and subsequent annual market returns. Here's how I arrived at the bell curve. We noted the broad market's PE each January 1st, going back to 1872, and ranked each year from low PE to high PE. Then we grouped them into intervals, creating the familiar bell curve-like shape, with otherwise unrelated years falling into buckets according to their PEs. The normal PEs fall in the fat part of the bell curve, while the high and low PEs fall on the edges. When you note the PE ratios for the past 139 years, along with the subsequent market return, some empirical truths emerge. Most startling? Most double-digit calendar year stock market declines, the monster drops everyone fears, occurred when PEs were below 20, not when they were very high. In the past 139 years, there were 20 times the U.S. market's total return was negative, more than 10%. 16 times, 80% of those most negative years were on the middle to low end of the P.E. range, based on the bell curve. 15, 75%, happened in the fat part of the curve, on normal P.E.s. Hardly fodder for a myth. Anyone can get these data off the internet. Anyone can array them. It doesn't take fancy math. It just takes a little effort. But most people don't ask, so they don't try. And since they don't try, the myth still exists. So big double-digit drops don't automatically follow high PE markets. But since the myth is so widely and rigidly believed, could there be some kernel of truth to it? For example, high PE markets must fall more often than those with low PEs, even if they aren't the monster drops. Right? Well, no. PEs were below 22.8 in 116 of those years, and the market finished in negative territory 32 times, 27.5%. Of those 17 years when PEs were 22.8 or higher, the historically high end of the PE range, the market ended down 7 times, 30.4%. Neither high nor low PE markets did materially worse. You've heard the data. You're henceforth unshackled from this investing old wives' tale. Here's a simple test you can use repeatedly. Someone tells you X causes Y in America's markets, like the PE example, and even has data to demonstrate it's true. If it's really true in America, then it must also be true in most foreign developed markets. If it isn't similarly true in most other developed Western markets, it isn't really true about capitalism and capital markets, and hence, isn't really true about America. Just a chance outcome. I'll not belabor you with the data here. This book already does too much of that. But if you take the same bell curve approach we used for America's stock market and apply it to foreign markets, the only country where low PE markets seemed materially better is Britain. And that is based on a few relatively big years. Elsewhere, you get the same randomness as in America. Whenever anyone tells you something works a certain way in America, a good cross-check is to see if it also works outside America, because if it doesn't really work robustly in America either. Some will say, you must see the high PE problem in the right way. Warning, a precursor to a re-engineering attempt to support a myth, and it won't likely hold. For example, they may agree it isn't just that a high PE is worse than a low PE, but when you get over a certain PE level, the risk skyrockets, and when you get under a certain PE, it plummets. For example, they may assert market PEs over 25 are bad, and PEs under 15 good, and everything in between is what confuses everyone, throwing the averages off, leading you to not see things the way they would have you see them. Fair enough. That's easy to test. You take all the times when the market had a PE over 25 and envision we sold and then bought back at some level. You pick it, I don't care what it is, as long as you apply it consistently. It turns out, historically, regardless of the level picked, none really beats a long-term buy and hold in America. The same is true overseas, except again in Britain, where you can make a weak case a low PE has had a variety of approaches seeming to work, but only in Britain, which is probably just a coincidence, and if you throw out a very few very big years in Britain from a very long time ago, it falls apart there too. Suppose you sell when the market's PE hits 22 and buy when it falls to 15. That approach lags a simple buy and hold. Suppose you change the 22 to 23. Still lags. How about dropping the 15 to 13 or raising it to 17? Still lags. What's more, there isn't a buy and sell approach that works overseas. You may
disbelieve all this. Great! Prove I'm wrong.
To prove it, you must find a buy and sell rule based on simple PE beating the market with 1, 2, and 3 year returns. It must work basically the same way in a handful of foreign developed markets, and if you start or end your game on different dates. Try to find it. Maybe you're better than I am, but I looked and looked and can't find it in any way anyone would believe. Every time a high PE market leads to very bad returns, like in 2000, 2001, and 2002, you will find a comparable number of examples where it does well, like 1997, 1998, 1999, 2003, and 2009. There is simply no basis for this myth. Always look at it differently. Investors fall prey to myth because they're used to seeing investing truisms in accepted and normal ways, as they were taught. Once you start thinking even a bit differently, not in a complicated way, just differently, like graphing a bell curve or looking for the same phenomenon overseas, myths tend to fall apart. Whenever you're confirming an investing belief, try it from a fresh angle. Go crazy, be creative. Flip things on their heads, backward and inside out. Hack them up and go over their guts. Instead of trying to be intuitive, think counterintuitively, which may turn out to be much more intuitive. For fun, let's look at why, intuitively, high PEs don't spell disaster for stocks. Most investors look at stocks with high PEs and assume their prices are too high relative to the company's earnings. If a price is proportionately much greater than earnings, so goes the thinking, the stock must be overpriced. What goes up must come down. What investors forget is the P isn't the only moving variable in the PE. In years following high PE markets, earnings often rose faster than share prices, and often after low PE years, we ran into unexpected rough economies where earnings vanished. In fact, in 1929, the most famous market peak of all time, PEs were low, not high, because the soon-to-disappear earnings were too high in 1929, making the PE low. When we buy stocks, we're buying future earnings. At some times, we're willing to pay more than at others. In high PE markets, earnings often exceed expectations, as in 2003 and 2009. And the market prices in higher earnings before we can see them coming. Just by considering what is happening with the denominator side of the PE, looking at it differently, you can reason for yourself why the myth is wrong. The myth that high PE markets are dangerous and low PE markets are safe persists. But anyone with a dial-up modem and a pencil can see high PE years are, in themselves, not any worse than lower PE periods. Why does this myth persist? Because, fundamentally, TGH is perverse and counterintuitive. It can be painful to accept whatever is fueling your water cooler debates is wrong and already priced into markets. It's humbling, but true. How would your grandparents think about it? Now I'll steal a page from Chapter 3 and focus on how our brains blindside us on the PE issue. There's a genetic reason people fear high PE markets. I can't prove this, but I believe it's true. And you can't disprove it. It's a pretty different way to see this dilemma. You inherited your genes and the information processor that is your brain from your parents, as did they from theirs. Your far-distant ancestors had brains adept at processing certain types of information, that which related to problems they encountered, related to passing on their genes successfully. Were that not true, you and I wouldn't be here. The folks back then who didn't process information well relative to those problems don't have descendants walking the earth now. Your brain wasn't really set up to deal with the stock market. It was set up to deal with problems of basic human survival. One problem your ancestors learned to process was heights.
If they fell from greater heights, the risk of death or crippling, pretty much the same back then, was exponential. Higher heights increased risk. Falling from 2 feet is just a stumble. Falling from 10 feet isn't all that tough for a 10-year-old jumping off a roof, but bone-breaking for older people. Falling from 40 feet kills usually, and from 400 feet? Always. Folks learned well when confronted with problems appearing in a framework of heights. More height meant more risk. Greater heights meant you could fall farther. Exactly how people think of PEs. They envision higher PEs as farther potential falls and lower PEs as less distance to smack into the floor. So there is less smacking risk. Anytime I present information to you in a form appearing as a heights framework, more height scares you and less height seems safer. If I can present the same information in a way not involving heights, your fear fades instantly. We do that in a few moments. A quick preview of question 3. When the market's PE is higher than normal, most investors know it. Even those who don't know what PE stands for can tell you these days the market is frighteningly overvalued. Their resulting fear of heights and concern over possibly sustaining a loss can be explained by a behavioral finance truism. People hate losses much more than they like gains. People talk about investors being risk-averse, but that isn't quite right. Investors are probably loss-averse. Two pioneers in the field of behavioral finance, Daniel Kahneman and the late Amos Tversky, demonstrated and proved normal Americans, yes, you're probably pretty normal, hate losses about 2.5 times as much as they like gains. Investors feel the sting of a momentary loss much more intensely than they enjoy the pleasure of a gain. In your heart, you probably already knew that was true of you. And because loss is more agonizingly painful than gain is pleasant, investors will do more to avoid losses than to achieve gains. Investors will actually adopt additional risk if they believe it can help them avoid a loss they would otherwise incur. Kahneman and Tversky described this phenomenon in what they called prospect theory. They discovered normal investors, again, you, confuse actual risk with the perception of risk, all in the effort to avoid the possibility of a loss. The perception, or one could say misconception, of possible losses, long misassociated with high PE markets, is what keeps investors fearful in what could otherwise be a relatively low-risk market environment. The same powers are at work at the bottom of a bear market. Investors are typically most fearful at the end of bear markets when risk is diminished and upside potential considerable. Investors' perceptions are just off. Investors, particularly many who consider themselves value investors, have had violent and near-religious reactions to this notion. Instead of practicing introspection and asking themselves question 1, what do I believe that is wrong? They grab at any straw to disavow their influence by a very natural bias. In rebuttal, they claim the phenomenon occurs because ultra-high PEs come from suppressed earnings posted at the end of a recession. Not quite. This sometimes happens, but it's far from universal. It certainly wasn't true in 1996, 1997, 1998, and 1999. To excuse that, investors say the markets are just irrational. Investors' vehemence that ultra-high PEs must have a high risk is another aspect of the perverseness of TGH. Upside down and backward, if you can. We've demonstrated how to use question 1 with a well-entrenched misconception. As you strike out on your own, testing your own mythology, make sure you're thorough. A good scientist doesn't stop once he gets the answer to a question. He looks at it repeatedly, from different angles. First, be realistic about your findings. Don't jump to conclusions too fast. One might consider the previous data and create a new myth. High PEs are predictive of above-average returns. Don't fall for that trick. The evidence here is enough to utterly decimate any wrong-headed belief about high PEs being bad for stocks. Anything more is inconclusive. It isn't enough. It isn't overwhelming. It won't let you bet and win much more often than you lose. Ultimately, you should take away PEs aren't, by themselves, a predictor of future results. Furthermore, if you get just one result supporting your hypothesis, no matter how remarkable, it's happenstance, not a pattern. This is true for anything you encounter. You don't want to make a bet based on happenstance. For example, you might be tempted to conclude ultra-high PE markets tend to be low risk and high reward. Yes, it is true ultra-high PEs have led to some great stock returns, but there haven't been enough occurrences to make this anything more than an interesting observation, and probably coincidence. As you create and test, you must test as many occurrences as you find. We now know PEs have no predictive power. So, is the PE good for anything? To find out, we need to steal a page again from Chapter 2 and Question 2. What can we fathom about PEs that is hard for others to fathom? A standard trick to help you see better and see things others don't is to look at it from a different perspective. One powerful way to test your belief and results is to flip your myth on its head and see what you see then. So, take the PE and flip it on its head. By putting the earnings over the price in this equation, you have the exact same information in a different framework. The earnings to price ratio, better called the earnings yield. This is simply the inverse of the PE, the EP. Investors are used to seeing expected returns of bonds and cash quoted in yields, whereas most investors are accustomed to valuing stocks by their PEs. By inverting the PE and looking at the earnings yield, you can compare apples to apples. What's more, you also escape the heights framework just discussed. We have discussed how to take a PE and arrive at an earnings yield. A PE of 20 is really a price of $20 divided by $1 of earnings. So the EP for this is 1 divided by 20, or 5%. When you think of the relationship as an earnings yield, it compares better to interest rates. As we see later, it should. And the Heights framework scaring us about PE disappears instantly. The PE of 20 scares you, but the earnings yield of 5% doesn't. It's pretty easy math. Again, no Stephen Hawking automaton necessary. This comparison is more rational and straightforward than determining if a stock is cheap or expensive based on PE alone. Since stocks and bonds compete for investor dollars, the comparison of bond yields and stock earnings yields gives you something concrete for comparison. For example, if you have a high market with a PE of 20, most folks would say that seems high. How do you think about a 5% earnings yield? If bond interest rates are 8%, the 5% earnings yield might not be attractive, but if bonds are 3%, it could be. Compare that with going bond yields now. Before you think a stock market or single stock with a 5% earnings yield is inferior to, say, a 6% U.S. Treasury bond, remember the tax treatment. The earnings yield is effectively a company's after-tax annualized cost of raising expansion capital by selling stock. What does that mean? Since the PE is an after-tax number, you know the EP is an after-tax number too. A company can get expansion capital by selling stock or issuing a corporate bond. But if it issues a corporate bond, the interest paid on that bond is deductible for tax purposes against revenue. The corporate bond rate is a pre-tax number. The EP is an after-tax number. Suppose the stock has a PE of 20 and it's an average-grade corporation, meaning a BBB corporate bond rating. As 2011 ended, it could borrow 10-year money through a bond at about 4.6%. Assuming a 33% tax rate, the 4.6% cost is really 3.1% after tax. To get the tax-adjusted equivalent, multiply the 4.6% rate by 1 minus 33% tax rate, or 0.67. The stock's EP is 5% already after tax, so it's cheaper to raise expansion capital by issuing a bond at 3.1% than selling stock at 5%. Corporate bond rates would have to rise above 7.5% to make it cheaper for that PE20 company to get expansion capital by selling stock. That is the firm's viewpoint. From your viewpoint, it's somewhat different. The earnings yield needn't be above the tax-adjusted bond yield to make stocks more attractive than bonds. When you buy stocks, you do so assuming future earnings will be somewhat higher due to subsequent future growth. Stocks, as a group, tend to generate earnings growth over time, sometimes more, other times less. But a bond coupon is fixed. You know it has no chance of rising. If you hold it to maturity, you will get that interest rate. When you buy stocks, you're actually buying the future average earnings yield, which is likely somewhat higher than the current earnings yield. When you buy bonds, the future average bond yield is the current yield. For this reason, the current earnings yield needn't be higher than the bond yield to make stocks attractive relatively. Interestingly, the earnings yield for the U.S. stock market and the bond yield have historically tracked pretty close to each other, at least since 1985. Times when the earnings yield has been above the bond yield, it wasn't by much, but these usually marked good times to own stocks. Why? When the earnings yield is above the bond yield, stocks are typically undervalued relative to bonds. Translation: stocks are relatively cheap. Since 2002, the earnings yield has been higher than bond yields in America, so stocks have been historically very cheap. Just when most folks said they weren't cheap, but high, because PEs were above historic averages. If you had let high PEs scare you out of stocks, you would have missed the entirety of the 2002 to 2007 bull market and the powerful initial bull market years of 2009 and 2010. Keep in mind, this is by no means a forecasting tool. The gap was also wide during the 2008 bear market, but it is one way to assess rationally how firms are likelier to raise capital and whether stocks are over or undervalued relative to bonds. Just because stocks are relatively cheap doesn't mean they must rise or that they must outperform relative to bonds. Stocks can be cheap and get cheaper still, and the reverse is true for bonds. But we aren't done yet. Remember, if something is true here, it should be true in most foreign developed countries. We can see all around the world earnings yields exceed bond yields now, and by more than in America, and that too is uncommon. Stocks are cheaper globally in recent years compared to long-term interest rates than they've been in a quarter century. When you are really, really wrong. We've talked about those myths perpetuated by investors inventing or imagining causal correlations where none exist. What about those myths so wrong the inverse is actually true? Sometimes, when you ask question one, you discover you have been not only wrong, but really, really wrong. Don't fret. Discovering you have been wrong and uncovering a reverse truth gives you yet another basis for a market bet. A powerful one, because you know for certain everyone is betting on the exact opposite of what you know is likely to happen. It may be hard for you to imagine something you and your fellow investors can get so completely wrong, but there are some myths in the misguided investor doctrine held so dearly, questioning them is almost sacrilegious. Suggesting such a belief be scrutinized if only to confirm its veracity, would bring outrage, scandal, and possible excommunication. These myths, the most sacrosanct beliefs in the investor and social catechism, those no one dares question, are sometimes ones we find to be so wrong, the exact opposite holds true. The Holiest of Holies, the Federal Budget Deficit Myth. You probably believe a high federal budget deficit is bad.
Everybody knows budget deficits are bad. How do we know? We know because everyone knows. Duh.
Pundits, politicians, patriots, perverts, poker partners, your parents, your pet parakeet, and worst of all, Sean Penn, Brad Pitt, and Dolly Parton. Everyone. More important, everyone believes it.
There is absolutely no reason to question this belief. I mean, how do you question Sean Penn and Brad Pitt?
Which makes this sacredly held myth a great candidate for question one. What do you believe that is wrong? Better yet, reframe and flip it on its head and ask yourself the reverse. Is a high federal budget deficit good? And good for stocks? Ask that question too loudly, and someone may come after you with a butterfly net and commit you to a nice, safe, padded cell. Believing a budget deficit is bad is part of our collective Western world wisdom and culture, nay, our civic duty. As stated earlier, deficit has the same Latin root as deficient. Why question something believed for thousands of years? Because it's wrong. We are taught as children to regard debt as bad, more debt as worse, and a lot of debt as downright immoral. Right after we finished making paper turkeys for Thanksgiving, we got a cookie, some apple juice, and a lecture on the immorality of debt, and then nap time. As a society, we're morally opposed to debt. We haven't evolved too far from our Puritan forefathers in this regard, and deficits make more debt. Abhorring a budget deficit isn't just an American sentiment. Other inhabitants of Western developed nations fret as we do over deficits, in many places, more so. Come to think of it, they fret over ours too, more than theirs. Is any of this anxiety deserved? Looking at the past 20 years or so, America has run a federal budget surplus in just 4 years. During the budget surplus of the late 1990s, the stock market peaked, leading to a bear market and the start of a recession. That recession was fairly short-lived and shallow, but the bear market persisted 3 years and was huge. Clearly, the budget surplus didn't lead to outstanding stock returns. If there is no empirical evidence supporting the hypothesis, yes, Virginia, it's just a hypothesis, that budget deficits are bad for stocks, could the opposite be true? It appears so. The counterintuitive truth is stock market returns following periodic deficit extremes have been much higher on average than surplus peaks or even decreasing deficits. Considering a 12-month subsequent return after budget surpluses and comparing them with returns after deficits, which world do you want to be living in? The one with the average return of 16.7% or the one with the average return of minus 1.2%? Looking out over 36-month returns, those appalling deficits get you an average cumulative return of 27.1%, compared with 8.8% from the surpluses. The plain truth is, since 1947, if an investor had purchased stocks at federal budget deficit extremes, he or she would have seen 1, 2, and 3 year returns much higher on average than if purchased at high budget surplus periods. Buying in the aftermath of budget surpluses would have rendered materially below average returns. If you're beginning to think perhaps budget surpluses aren't the best thing to happen to stocks, you're getting it. If you suspect the wry hand of TGH, you're also getting it. Budget surpluses aren't a panacea. They historically lead to bad markets. don't wish for them. This may not make sense at first blush. Conventional wisdom depicts a deficit as some sort of gigantic anchor holding down the economy and ramming debt down its over-indebted throat. As consumers, we're careful to not overdraw our checking accounts and believe the government should do the same. Many politicians will have you believe deficits must be reduced, and now. There are no politicians saying more debt is good, although there are often politicians advocating tax cuts, which can cause a similar effect. Let's kill the bloodsuckers. If you don't know the origin of the word politics, let me enlighten you. The word politics comes from the Greek poly, meaning many, and tix, meaning small blood-sucking creatures. Unless a politic stands up and announces, "I routinely lie, cheat, and steal to help my career and care nothing about you, whoever you are," you should take anything he says with a grain of salt. People have some difficulty with this. You know you dislike any politic saying things ideologically you dislike. And you know he is dishonest, a slimeball, and someone if whom your daughter planned to marry, you would instead seek a cult deprogrammer to protect her. What you have difficulty accepting is when another politic says things you like and believe in, that he or she is simply lying. Of course, that's just my view. Suppose I'm wrong. Politics, overwhelmingly, aren't students of capital markets. More than anything else, they tend to be lawyers. Some exceptions, like Presidents Eisenhower, Carter, Reagan, and Bush, or even Arnold Schwarzenegger. Don't look to them to be experts in finance or economics. They may be honest enough until they become beltway blowhards, but they still aren't experts on markets and economics and will never use the three questions. Politics never think about when they're wrong, how to fathom what others can't fathom, and how to see when their brains are misguiding them. Politics couldn't use the three questions if they had to. Perhaps I've been bombastic for comedy's sake in the past few paragraphs, but you'll be a better investor and sleep better at night if you tune out approximately 97% of what politics say. That budget deficits are good for stocks isn't a lucky fluke. Economically, it makes sense if you can get yourself to think about debt and deficits correctly. We cover that in Chapter 6. For now, suppose budget deficits really are good for stocks in America and surpluses really are bad. If that is true, we ought to be able to see it happening close to the same way in other developed Western nations. The trick is a really nifty one most folks never use, and we do see it overseas. In other developed nations, as I demonstrate for you in Chapter 6, budget deficits have preceded good stock market returns and surpluses have preceded gloomier times. This isn't a socioeconomic political statement. All we are doing is looking at cold hard facts and encouraging you to do the same. Folks who are hamstrung by bias are plagued with misconception and can't see the truth even when it's right there in front of them. Instead, always ask if what you believe is actually false. What about those other deficits? The federal budget deficit isn't the only deficit boogeyman getting investors' knickers knotted. As soon as I tell you the budget deficit isn't bad for stocks, your reaction may be dismissal, anger, and then a framework shift. That other deficits, like the trade deficit, must be bad. You've heard it so often, you've also heard it's bad for the dollar. We look at such assertions in both Chapters 6 and 7, where I show these two forms of deficit aren't bad for stocks or the dollar. I mention this here as another version of something everyone believes that is false. Note, you've heard it, accepted it, believed it was true, winced every time a new record trade deficit number was announced, but never stopped to ask, "I know I believe it's bad, but is it really? And how would I check?" Because you know in your heart, if everyone is wrong, and trade deficits aren't bad for the stock market and the dollar, it would be tremendously bullish, because that would be one less thing to fret that, to most folks, is a huge burden. And that is something you can know others don't. It's all relatively relative. Part of the reason investors freak out about deficits, budget, trade, and otherwise, is they forget to think relatively, a cognitive error. They hear we have an estimated $500 billion trade deficit as of the end of 2010. Holy cow, that's a lot of moolah, they think. $500 billion? I don't have $500 billion. Not even Bill Gates has that much. News editors and talking heads lambast whomever they think is responsible, using words like record-breaking, staggering, and irresponsible to describe the deficit size. Well, of course it sounds high. But is it? Are our perceptions right? To see this correctly, we must scale. You must look at our trade deficit as a percentage of our overall economy. If you think $500 billion is a lot, what do you think about $14.5 trillion? That's the comparable size of America's GDP, also at year-end 2010. As a percentage of our national income, the trade deficit is a mere 3.4%. What's more, as a historical average, it's nothing to sweat about either. The media won't mention the trade deficit as a percentage of GDP, however, because they assume you're rational and won't get overexcited over a trade deficit that is 3.4% of our overall income. This doesn't work just with deficits. Anytime the media tries to scare you with huge numbers, think about it relatively. Think scale. Question everything you know. Success in investing requires you to question everything you think you know, particularly those things you think you really, really know. Using question one properly gives you discipline to start preventing some basic errors. The ability to just avoid mistakes is key to successful investing. As you examine mythology and begin discovering faulty logic, don't simply correct it once and forget about it. Investing is an applied science, not a craft. If you get a validated answer to a hypothesis, don't assume you can apply the results always and everywhere and get the same result. TGH is an ever-changing opponent requiring constant retesting of hypotheses. Knowing big federal budget deficits don't necessarily signal bad times ahead, and may in fact signal the reverse, is fairly shocking, though undeniably true. Someday, in some future universe, the investing public may relinquish this myth and realize the whole world has been wrong on this point. Should that occur, you will have lost your edge. Then you will no longer know something others don't. When everyone knows federal budget deficits are to be cheered, not jeered, the market will efficiently price it in. By using question one and constantly retesting your investing doctrine, you won't fall prey to such an event, implausible though it is. You may say, and it's a great thing to say, but if you tell me in this book the market's PE has nothing to do with future returns and big budget deficits are bullish, not bearish, won't the whole world know? And then won't it stop working? If the world embraces these truths, then because the market is a discounter of all widely known information, these truths would become priced into markets, and knowing them wouldn't give you an edge. They wouldn't work because you wouldn't know anything others don't widely know. But that didn't happen after I first published this book in 2007. Most of the myths in this book persist. I bet it doesn't happen in 2012 either. I'll bet most folks who listen to Chapter 1 will think the notions expressed about PEs and deficits are so screwy, they ignore them completely and fall back on the mythologies. That would be comfortable and easy. Most investors will never see this book. And of those buying it, half won't read it. Of those who do, many won't get past this chapter in disgust. They will reject the truth, prefer mythology, and see me as silly. I hope they do, because when I see them see me as silly and wrong, I know I will be able to use these truisms for a long time. If they adopt most of these truisms, I'll need to come up with new ones to know something others don't. Whereas the Campbell-Schiller paper was rapidly embraced and quickly became globally famous and popular because it supported the standard mythology, evidence contradicting market mythologies fortunately tends to be about as noticed as a rock thrown into a lake, a minor ripple followed by near-instant absence from societal memory. This isn't the first time I've written about the high P.E. myth. I first started 15 years ago. I'll bet it is as prevalent 5 and 10 years from now as it is today. And you can still make gameable bets on it. Because, of course, I could be wrong, and then you move on to the next myth. That's life. The real benefit of question one is it allows you to know something others don't know by knowing where you otherwise would have been wrong, but thought you were right. Once you master the skill of doing this, you can improve yourself forever with it. You can keep learning things others don't know while reducing your own propensity to make mistakes. Discovering new investing truths is a coincidental result of asking question one. A lucky accident. If you're purposefully seeking what no one else knows, you must also learn to use and apply question two. What can you fathom that others find unfathomable? Even contemplating such a thing seems pretty unfathomable to most people. But that is exactly what we start doing if you simply allow me to continue to chapter two. Chapter 2. Question 2. What can you fathom that others find unfathomable? Fathoming the unfathomable. Fathoming the unfathomable by definition seems unfathomable, so most folks don't try. However, like question 1, it doesn't require any additional scholarship, genetic superiority, or magical superhero powers. All you need is question two. What can I see that others can't? The more you ask, the more you can see. Since the only basis for a market bet is knowing something others don't, this question can provide the second basis for a bet. Go ahead and ask yourself, what do I know that others don't? At this point, your answer may be, well, nothing. It's most people's immediate reaction. Don't be discouraged. You won't be bombarded with question twos like you are with question ones. We get bombarded with investing nonsense daily. Discovering something others don't know isn't a eureka moment. It's not the apple falling on Newton's head. It's what happened afterward when Newton asked, "I wonder what the heck made that happen?" and contemplated what forces, natural or sinister, could be at play. It's the reflection in a quiet room away from the incessant market and media noise when you wonder if factor Q could possibly cause result Y, when everyone else is yammering on about X causing Y. The world is busy insisting high PEs cause poor stock prices, wrong, usually. Debt is bad for stocks, wrong. You shouldn't fight the Fed, wrong about half. And high trade deficits cause a weak dollar. Wrong, wrong, wrong. But to know something others don't, you tune out the noise and wonder, if everything everyone insists moves currencies doesn't, I wonder what actually does. We go there in Chapter 7. And if I shouldn't fight the Fed, is it possible the yield curve can tell me anything at all about stocks? Or must I just look at it differently somehow? I wonder. Wondering is wonderful. Wondering is wonderful. Suppose no one has a clue what causes result Y. If everyone knows no one knows what causes Y, then probably almost no one is willing to think about what causes why, because they will believe it a waste of time. In our contemporary world, in America and more so elsewhere, if something is seen as unfathomable, normal people will treat it as a complete untouchable. These areas are especially ripe for inquiry because they are so virginal. Misapplication of question 2 can lead you to waste time plowing through common media sources for clues. Through the miracle of mass production and electronics, pretty much all media is everywhere and all around us constantly. Your investment edge won't present itself in a ready-to-use format, in a front-page news story, in any publication, or in an evening news program or blog or email newsletter. No matter how buried a news item or how insignificant a blog, we live in a fast-moving world. Your news edge almost certainly will be snatched from you before you've found it. Don't despair. You can still use all that widespread noise to help you find something no one else knows. All it requires is fighting eons of behavioral conditioning. Here's how. Ignore the rock in the bushes. Thousands of years ago, our ancestors grouped together for security against other tribes and giant fanged beasts. When darkness fell, they gathered around campfires for warmth, protection, and the occasional grilled mammoth burger. By the glowing campfire, they regaled each other with stories of the hunt.